Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
Good morning, folks. What up?
This is October 28th, 2020, and we're on episode 111 of Transmission.
111. I was thinking as I saw that, is there, I wonder what cosmic significance we could
ascribe to
that.
Yeah, there's got to be like a numerology thing with that. It's not 1111, but I mean, it's three quarters of the way there.
Three ones and one three is, it's the Trinity. And we are three of us, and we are each one. One.
There we go.
Boom.
Yeah, we're excited. We've got a guest today. We haven't had a guest in a while, it seems like.
It's been a while.
Cool. Who's our guest today, guys?
Yeah. Who's our guest?
The man in the middle, Seymour Perspective. Cool. Which you can't, I don't think you can all see it. It says Seymour Perspective, but it's the V is dropped off. You'll have to take
it. Depends on your... Depends on your perspective whether you can see it or not.
Indeed. Just to introduce ourselves, I'm Mark Van Sunik. I'm the director for the Center for Prophetic Imagination.
And I'm Daniel Wolpert. I direct MICA, the Minnesota Institute of Contemplation and Healing.
I'm Seymour Perspective, and I am the director of Wisdom and Knowledge in Hip Hop Culture for the People.
Nice. That's a sweet gig to get.
That's awesome.
I'm one of many, to be fair.
One ambassador amongst many, I see.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
A steward.
So we've invited you along in part because recently there has been a little bit of a flurry around hip hop artists, a couple of them coming out for Trump and or talking to Trump, engaging Trump. Mm-hmm. I guess 50 Cent is going to move somewhere if Biden wins. I guess nobody's told him that there aren't any countries that will take Americans right now because of the pandemic.
50 Cent said that about Biden?
Yeah. Yeah.
50 Cent came out and said that he was approached by Trump to be paid to be vocal and supportive. And now he's done it?
Yeah. So
he's clearly being paid.
Well, he claims Biden's tax plan is not... That is not good for him.
Interesting.
Interesting. I mean, it raises all sorts of questions. I think this, the idea, Catherine recruited you in an episode about white embodiment, where we talked about appropriation and kind of the way in which white people, because we're uprooted from our own roots, I guess, are parasitic of other cultures. And this kind of comes in, like anytime I feel like, you know, like Ice Cube is one of the latest people. It just seems like it brings up all sorts of questions over about race, about the role of hip hop, the way in which white people will claim blackness when it suits them. It's just so there's lots of fodder for you to bring your wisdom and insight as an official ambassador of hip hop culture for the people.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, it's, you know, it's really sick. I think that hip hop has always been undercut and used by corporations to either support people's biases and racism or seed it. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Because it's always been an art form, a cultural art form, from and for the people, you know, born in oppression. And once they couldn't control it, they actually passed legislation to control which companies would be in charge of playing the music on the radio stations, which was like a few of them. It's the Telecommunications Act of 96. And it's no accident that 96 is the year that hip hop turned all out sellout, right? Like before, there was everything. There was a mix. Public Enemy, De La Soul, KRS-One. They were on the radio, right? They were mainstream. And of course, there was Vanilla Ice and there was MC Hammer or whoever, you know?
Who are my entry points into hip hop?
There was a balance, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And you had mainstream artists saying these guys are garbage and they're whack, you know? KRS-One would show up on a stage and like punch somebody in the face for being whack. And he would say these things in their songs, you know? And so when in 1996, they changed the control of the airwaves with the Telecommunications Act. And suddenly it was all materialism.
Mm.
Right. It was that was the Jiggy era. Like that's a specific era in time from 96 to 2000, probably is the Jiggy era. And unless you were in tune with, you know, what was happening in the underground, it would have been easy to think that that was the only thing that was happening in hip hop.
Mm-hmm.
And that hip hop was garbage, right? That it was all misogynist and violent and materialistic, you know?
Mm-hmm. So maybe back in way, way up, you know, not assuming that that all our viewers are aware of all these different things, maybe you could just give us a little bit of a history.
Yeah,
so sure. Like if somebody said, like, well, what is hip hop? What does that mean? You know, I'm out in the suburbs. I'm seeing these white kids flashing gang signs and wearing their hats funny. And, you know, like, what is this thing?
They're all over my lawn.
Yeah, totally. I mean, so yeah, it's really funny how like clueless people are about hip hop and hip hop culture. You know, they see like a kid's tag and they're like, oh, there are these gangs. There's a new gang in their neighborhood. And it's just like some kid like promoting some sense of like justice and spirituality through like a word. And he's not part of any gang. You know, maybe he has some friends that he draws with at 2 a.m., you know, listening to music. Not that I know from personal experience.
No.
So this is an art form. This is a culture that has its roots in West Africa with the griot, which is an oral tradition in West Africa of keeping history, of keeping culture, of keeping stories of a people, of a place, of a specific region, town, village, or whatever. And the griot is a role in society, G-R-I-O-T. And when Africans are brought to the United States against their will, obviously they have so many skills, talents, wisdom. These are civilized human beings with a lot of skills and talents that are exploited. And one of the things that is brought with them is this tradition of the griot. That transforms into the blues with, you know, I always give the example of the parallel example of, I forget the name of the instrument, but it's like, you know, it's a dried gourd, you know, with some strings or whatever. You know, sounds like a banjo. And that's how the banjo was born, right? Was this traditional instrument from West Africa, being, you know, that the knowledge being brought here with different resources, with different tools and different context, and suddenly you have the banjo, right? And that traditional instrument is still being played, and that's a living tradition, as is the tradition of the griot, right? It just changed in the United States. And, you know, that sliver of like what was, you know, stolen and brought here against its will created the blues, which is like ridiculously influential, right? That's all modern American music, right? If it's American music, it doesn't happen without the blues coming first, you know, except, of course, Native American music, right? Indigenous music is obviously American. So that leads to the blues, to jazz, which opens up with the Harlem Renaissance. Langston Hughes leads the charge. You know, these are incredible writers, thinkers, and voices of an identity that is reclaiming itself, right? That's the Renaissance aspect of it. And you have Langston Hughes, who is considered the godfather of spoken word, but this is hip hop in a way, because this is a twin culture. This is a twin art form. And so when you're talking about the history of hip hop, you're also talking about the history of spoken word. So this is a cultural tradition with deep roots and very meaningful writing and storytelling. And of course, it is undermined by racist record executives, you know, across pop culture for the last several decades. So eventually it's born, you know, and you have different stops along the way. And, you know, you can even count the beat poets among that, because they were writing, you know, like writing poetry as if it was jazz and that kind of thing, you know. But then you land at the last poets, Gil Scott-Heron, and they're really like the midwives of hip hop and spoken word. You have the last poets, who are considered like the first hip hop group and first spoken word group, which is, I always think, is great, because they're the last poets, but they're the first spoken word poets. and then Gil Scott-Heron, who, you know, considers himself a bluesologist, so he really knows the traditions he's drawing upon and reaching back to take the baton and move it forward. And so then somewhere, you know, in the mid 70s, I think they're credited, you know, as 76 being the year that like hip hop was actually born. I think 79 was like the first like radio single that came out, which always means that something else was happening. Like the Sugar Hill Gang, you know, was like hired to do this thing, mm-hmm. you know. They weren't the pioneers. They were the first on the radio. And they were kind of like brought on to do the thing that other people were doing, you know, in the Bronx in New York, that they were doing in the park and at house parties and that kind of thing, right? So you have hip hop as a culture, which means there are different aspects of this culture. There are the four elements. There's MCing, which is rapping. The cultural term would be MCing. There's the DJ. There's the beatboxer, which goes in with the DJ, or beat maker is in that realm. The musical aspect, the poetry, the visual art, graffiti, which has its own visual language that is like the visual aesthetic of this culture, of the oppressed, right? And then, of course, the breakdancers, who are the ones that are bringing these incredible, this incredible movement to the breaks, right, that are being taken from old records and reused and looped and cut up and poof. So they're the ones who are like getting loose on the breaks, the break boys, the break girls, the b-boys, the breakers.
Well, that's awesome. And you know, what's so great about hearing that history that you know, of course, we're all taught in the average American high school, right? you know, of hearing that history that most people have no idea about, is that, to me, it really shows that that intentional disembodying, right, that we were talking about in the episode of Embodiment and Whiteness, right, that you have this huge historical momentum that is coming from this trauma of bodies, right? Bodies being, you know, brought across the ocean, bodies being killed, bodies being enslaved, and this real mix of an attempt to keep these stories alive, an attempt to undermine this oppression, and then it comes all the way up into the modern age, right? And then, you know, let's dissociate all that. Let's package it, put the crappiest stuff we can find on the radio, mm-hmm. and then turn that against those same bodies. Oh, that hip hop, that's terrible, you know, bad, evil gang stuff. And
well, and let's make it cool and sexy. Cool. Tell everybody that this is the best stuff. So now it's poison in our own communities as well.
Yeah.
Well, it creates this interesting dynamic. I think part of what it means to be living in kind of this late modern consumer capitalist time is that most people aren't aware of how everything is commoditized. That's kind of how myths work. Like we're just not usually, generally speaking, aware of it.
Right.
And so I remember having all kinds of conversations as I was kind of like deepening my analysis, where I'd start encountering really overt racism from other white people. And then the fact that they enjoy, I like hip hop, is like this kind of, is this veneer, like this idea of mixing the enjoying the fruits of a culture as a commodity with somehow showing respect towards that culture is something that I think it's lost to a lot of folks, because we think commodities, this is how we engage one another, is through commodification. So the idea that somehow there's a way to enjoy hip hop as a white person in a way that is racist is hard for people to grapple with. Like what does it mean to show respect to these cultures and have a sense of mutuality and understand the power dynamic of how white interest in hip hop as a commodity, commodity has kind of done a lot of damage to not only hip hop culture, but also white people's capacity to find roots for themselves.
Right. Yeah. Like I think a lot about how, you know, the suburbs are like a cultural wasteland. And I think that some people hear me say that and they're like, what the fuck, Seymour? That's messed up. But it's like, no, like it's a wasteland because so much has been taken from, you know, from the synthesis of whiteness, you know? So much has been taken from people because in believing they're white, they've given up their cultures and their heritage, you know. It's a total falsehood, you know, that there is such a thing, right? I feel like we talk about this all the time, right? And so, you know, I think about the Sage Francis line, which is great, and he's a white hip-hop cat. It's been around for decades, and I quoted it to you the other day, Mark. He says, give me ethnicity or give me dreads.
I know where that quote came from. Thank you.
Yeah. And that's always stuck with me. I mean, that's a hell of a line. And I just think that people are so lost, and they don't, when they identify something as something they can relate to or look up to or whatever it is, they don't have the language to look within and say, damn, something is missing that I am desperately in need of. They're taught more. They have more of like even an intuitive language or process where they're entitled to take it and wear it. And we're seeing more and more of these like professors across the US who are pretending to be people of color. And it's because at some point they were like, I'm down, or maybe somebody told them they were down, or thought they were down, or they decided they were gonna be down. And then they were like, yeah, that means I can be that.
Right.
And, you know, people, I think a lot of people say, well, what's the difference between like being transgendered and being transracial? And it's like, well, you don't choose the identity of being trans, and you can't like take it off in a way, you know, like that's within you. And if you choose to be transracial, you can take it. You can take that off at any time. Right. You know what I mean? We see this with pop stars all the time, wearing hip hop and being like, now I'm hip hop or whatever. Miley Cyrus had a whole thing for a time where she was like, you know, really just kind of trying to rebel and be gross by like being all urban or whatever, you know? but then she discarded it as soon as it suited her.
All right. Well, we've got some comments coming in, so we should get to some of those.
Ellen brings up good, THC, and cat are all gematria. I'm not sure. I've never heard that term before for the number 111, among many more words and names.
Oh, fascinating.
So there's the numerology we needed.
There it is.
Thanks, awesome. Ellen. Okay. Sarah's writes, the Telecommunications Act in 1996. Wow, that part being influential in shifting hip-hop, that is new info for me as an English and media studies major who keeps up with media monopolies, nonsense, pop culture, and Marshall McLuhan.
That was a
Clinton thing.
Yep, that act, that was a big, big deal. You had all these, you know, people getting up there going, oh, this music is terrible. This, you know, we've got to regulate this. And
yeah, first it was explicit, blah, blah, blah.
Kipper Gore. Julie writes, rap equals rhythm and poetry. Ceres writes, white mediocrity ruins things. angry frown face.
I like that.
To reclaim media art and music back from the prison of white mediocrity that hates syncretism.
Yeah. You know, one of the things is as you were talking, Seymour, I was thinking about New Orleans and the hoodoo and voodoo cultures. And last time I was down there, I went to the Voodoo Museum, which is this tiny little museum, but it's just amazing. And, you know, and again, to me, this is another example of of not knowing and understanding history. I mean, all of just the amazing culture and music and sort of dancing and, you know, making spells to help the community. Well, yeah, right. you know, and just how that all came, you know, up into this country, right, through Africa and the Caribbean, and sort of the combining, you know, of all of these different influences that these oppressed peoples were having to, you know, come up against and deal with. It's just amazingly rich, right? Mm-hmm. And, you know, and again, when I think the average white person sort of, you know, sees some white guy get up with a banjo and play, right? They just have no idea.
It's of amazing.
Any of these connections.
Let me ask you what the whitest instrument you can think of is.
Usually people say the banjo.
Hell yeah, they do.
Yeah. I would say the accordion, but that's.
It's African, and that is beautiful.
Yeah.
Is the accordion still? Can we say the accordion is a white instrument? I don't know enough about the history of the accordion, but
yeah, I guess I don't know
because it's just so polka-y. You
know? Yeah.
Anyway, it just I mean it just strikes me that one of the worst things that oppression of any kind does is just to destroy and flatten the richness of culture.
Yeah.
And to really, yeah. And then when you add on the commodification aspect, I mean, it's so degrading on so many levels.
You create a single story, you become the only purveyor of that story, and you sell it and make money off of either people's biases or the appeal of the lie.
Yeah. No.
Ellen writes, the same as how Elvis stole music from Big Mama Thornton, commodified the soul of the songs, made a bunch of money, and contributed to the suppression of true musicians.
Yeah, the king of rock and roll, come on.
Yeah, right.
maybe the conquistador of rock and roll.
Right. I mean, if he's a product, I don't necessarily blame him. I think he really dug stuff people were doing. Did he say he was the originator? I don't know.
Like, I don't know if he did. And I would tend to, you know, I feel like the bad guys in all these biopics are always the producer, like the people come
absolutely.
From outside.
Absolutely.
So, like, let's blame them. Let's find out who the guy is that was behind Elvis's ascension and blame that guy.
Yeah. I choose to believe in the Elvis that kicks ass on the undead.
Bubba Hotep.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Great film. People need to watch Bubba Hotep.
It's
a classic.
Yeah.
Julia writes, the spirit of acquisition by, as Dr. Claudia May calls it, is part of the embodiment of entitlement.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
That's
no.
Agreed. No. Giannis writes, they were actually engaging in protests through art in defense of the oppressed and the enslaved. One of the reasons they had so great of an appeal, most companies would not even come close to the point that they had to produce their own records, which later on were commoditized as bling culture and cultural appropriation. Some songs were emblematic in the struggle, including gospel. And I don't know if things got cut off there, if that's where you were ending.
Yeah, and it's not even in defense of, just as the oppressed, standing up and saying, we're dope and we're beautiful and you're going to see us. I mean, these were people who were, you know, in the Bronx, like, if not invisibilized and ignored, demonized, you know, mm-hmm. like it was like a war zone, and that like people all around the country would refer to, and like there was no hope for it, you know. And and these were people, you know, like tagging on a wall is saying, hey, we're here, putting something beautiful in on an abandoned building or some business that doesn't represent you there. And then, what do? You cover it up with ugly gray paint, you know? So yeah. People talk about like, well, the braggadocio or whatever, they're all just so full of themselves. It's like, no, they're telling you that they're beautiful because you've ignored that fact.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So maybe say some more about how tagging culture ties into all this.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's kind of, you know, it's kind of the same. So it's just, we're here, we're dope, and it's almost always something, like the vast majority is something way more than people give it credit for. Mm-hmm. You know, sure, there are kids who are like tagging us, or they tag on somebody's garage door or whatever, and it's like, okay, we call them a toy, you know, they're just like, they don't know what they're doing, they shouldn't be, you know, tagging on somebody's personal property, or like, you know what I mean? But like, it should be like, they should be tagging the banks and the whatever, you know?
That's right.
And they should also come correct, right? But people focus in on that, which is this, this sliver of this worldwide culture, you mm-hmm. know, that creates incredible art. I mean, we're talking about serious creative ability and a lot of talent and skill. And I need to say skill, because when we start talking about how talented people are, we there's a whole racism in that it's like natural, that it's mm-hmm. like you just have it, and like, oh well, of course they do that because they're just blah blah blah, and that's this whole weird racism too, right? And there is a talent and there is a skill that people hone in on, and when, you know, no artist shows up overnight, you know what I mean, right? So it's mm-hmm. the same. And you know, somebody shows up into the new big thing, it's like, well, they've been doing that for at least a decade, if not more, you know, right. Until finally they struck some deal and here they are. And so there's a real spirituality and politic to, I mean, that's, it's political to raise your voice. It's political to tag a wall, you know? Mm-hmm. If nothing else, it's a fuck you. But oftentimes it's, we are here, we matter, we are vital, and we're not going away, no matter how you ignore us.
Right. All right.
Getting close to the end of time. We got a lot of comments.
Yep.
Okay. So Con writes, can I shamelessly plug my friend's book, Pastor Hip Hop? Talks a lot about the same things.
Cool.
I don't get royalties law. So StacyBJones.com. I'm assuming you can find it there. Catherine asks, when you teach hip hop and poetry in public schools, Seymour, how do you approach teaching white kids about participating respectfully in hip hop culture?
I think that my focus on that is teaching the history and the culture, and that like you can participate in this. But you can't own it. And so we develop a reverence for it and just like, this is where it comes from. This is the history. And so they're going to feel awkward if they just do something whack with it. You know, after we watched Gil Scott Heron and Langston Hughes and The Last Poets, you know? And so there's, it's just taught with a lot of reverence and respect, that I do see, through osmosis, I think.
Awesome. Kind of suggest bagpipes as.
Yeah, we're looking for the whitest instrument.
Yeah, and then Elizabeth says, "I love the accordion, popular in Latino music." So, with all that in mind, might I suggest the harpsichord? The
white instrument. I will say
there's something colonial about it.
The accordion is pretty colonial.
Yeah, right?
That was not there. That's true. Before the Spaniards were.
But then it's been like claimed in a way that the harpsichord has never been claimed.
This is true. This is definitely true.
By colonized people. So
it's, you know, the harpsichord is just not as portable. You can't bring your harpsichord to a party. You know?
Yeah. Well, just send the research department to look into while the answer is according to whiteness.
We got to get Max and Sarah to weigh in on this. I'm sure they've got some ideas about that.
Yeah, they need to weigh in. Ellen writes, I'm in a Zoom Bible study right now. Wow, double dipping. I see what you're doing. Where people are drawing connection between Psalms and Black spirituals as a way to record history. That's cool. That's a good parallel conversation to be having. Mm-hmm. Heather writes, the Black origin of banjo meant it wasn't accepted in white churches. Too worldly.
Interesting. Yeah, and Heather, of course, is coming out of Appalachia, where the banjo and a lot of these influences all came together. So that's an interesting point.
Ellen writes, like, literally right now I have anything you want to say to the people here? Keep the struggle alive. They can tell. Kathleen writes, I'm curious about the development of dance moves. Is there an African connection to line dancing? Is that like isn't that like a country thing? I don't know enough about
contra dancing.
It's interesting. Yeah, I
believe that has Black roots.
Contra dancing.
To me, it's all fascinating, like the way we get different forms, but then also this conversation topic that was just thrown in about white churches, to like what instruments are considered more sacred than others, being
right.
That might be another metric by which you determine how white something is, because the piano, which is not owned by white people, but that's like one of the most sacred instruments, according to like churches. Organ, of course.
Mm-hmm. Probably. Well, when you make hip hop, you know, it's not musical because you're not playing the piano or guitar.
That's right. Okay. Mark writes, curious about Seymour's thoughts on the Beastie Boys, cultural appropriation or appreciation and expansion of the art form.
Yeah, they were participants and they were cultural stewards. They were cultural practitioners, they were there. You know, they were there from the beginning, and I think they were used as a product initially, as just like, you know, Def Jam was like, we need a weird white hip hop group to come in and blah blah blah, and they blew them up. But these were people who actually really loved the art form, and they were punk kids to start with. So there's a lot in common with punk and hip hop that people don't realize. I mean, obviously, punk couldn't exist without the blues either.
Right.
but then the politics, there's a lot of parallels in the politics as well. And then so for them, when hip hop was being born, I mean, they were there, you know, they were around it, you know. And sure, they were invited in, but sold as a product, and definitely like the white hip hop group, which is always the thing, you know, like, well, white people can do this too or whatever. But they were definitely artists who were developing their own style. And once they got past that first album, I think they left Def Jam after that, and they were pretty sour about it. They felt used, and they felt like a lot of their voices were taken out of the creative process. And they had to work their way back out of that really as independent artists. So in terms of a power dynamic, I mean, they had to claw their way back into relevance, which is generally not not a place of power. And they're also they come from the Jewish community in New York as well. So I don't want people to forget that.
Heather writes, Hillbilly's use of banjo brings in class issues as well. Yeah, that's the other piece of it. When we talk about, I find that when people want to talk about whiteness, white people want to talk about whiteness as a bad thing. They'll always aim low. So then we always bring in like greasy country bumpkin type hillbilly. And so like this idea of the banjo kind of being tied to that, it's like we're going to reject this for all kinds of reasons, because it's not only like maybe it has African origins, but also like the white people who play it are kind of trashy.
Just like poor, dirty white people.
Sitting in their trailer parks having a hootenanny. Like this sort of kind of...
Philistines.
Yeah, exactly. Some links for people who are following along in some of these threads. Maybe you can click these links. I'm just going to post them up here. Just for people to know they're out there.
YouTube shows. All right. Well, we've blazed through again. This is awesome. Just barely scratched the surface.
I know, but, right?
Yeah, but really rich, and very much appreciate you coming on.
Thanks for having me.
Appreciate all the comments, and to Ellen and your Bible study. You know, be more radical. I don't know how radical you're being, but be even more radical.
We can always do it. We can always notch it up a little bit. You know?
That's right. And we actually will be here tomorrow. There was a little question about that, but I got the message. So we'll be back tomorrow. And then Monday, we're going to have another guest. So we'll probably say more about that as the week goes on. But Seymour, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank really you. Appreciate it.
All good right. To have you on this side of the
keyboard.
Peace, y'all.
See you, right.
Peace. Thank you.